appreciate your coming. We call the case of Blanton versus Quarterman, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Sullivan, Mr. Carroll, on behalf of Mr. Blanton, all present and ready, Your Honor.
Come right ahead.
As I've always understood the basic rules of the court, the court likes us to get right on into the arguments, everything having been read.
We've read it.
We submit to the court that oral argument can be divided into two basic categories. With respect to ineffective assistance of counsel, trial and appellate attorney's performance is at issue based on the handling of a Batson claim, more particularly the handling of a jury shuffle. There's a second claim with respect to whether or not the attorney was ineffective by the omissions by counsel with regards to investigating Mr. Blanton's background, more particularly specific medical records, and to develop the meaning of those medical records. With respect to the issue of whether trial counsel or appellate counsel was ineffective in handling the jury shuffle with respect to the Batson challenge, one of the principal issues that the federal district court addressed was the issue of what the federal district court entitled as clairvoyance. There is no question that—
Can I ask you a question about the practice of, and that was followed in this case by the state court in the seating of the venire persons? Our question specifically is that the initial seating the product of a truly mathematically random process, or is it just an ad hoc system?
My understanding, it is truly a random process. They take 100 jurors and put them into an order to begin with.
The order in which they are seated is created by a random selection process itself.
It is my understanding of the system, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So that a request for a shuffle is actually a second random shuffling of that particular selection. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
The first group that's selected randomly, let's say let's deal specifically with this case. How many members were there on the panel entirely?
100.
100?
100 members total on the panel. Bernard.
And there was 24 strikes on each side, or 36?
12 strikes on each side.
12?
12 strikes, Your Honor, I believe.
Okay.
And?
12 peremptors?
12 peremptors is my recollection, Your Honor, yes.
To each side?
To each side.
There are 24. So that your strike zone would then have been 66?
Depending on what happens with challenges, Your Honor.
Of course.
Naturally. As my understanding of the numbers, it would have to come out to that number.
By strike zone, I mean the first thing you do is to add up the number of peremptors and take them off the top and draw a line, because absent challenges for cause, you're burning a strike. And that's why you're working with a basic pool then of 66 persons.
And I,
I understand, but you've got cause, but it's a friendly question.
Yeah, I understand, Your
Honor. All right. So your strike line is 66, and then that may be shifting as you challenge. How were challenges for cause actually handled?
My understanding is challenges for cause would be brought when they were voir diring the specific jury member, so that they would know that they would be removed at that time.
Examined seriatim alone in the courtroom, or was the entire panel there getting the benefit of the early questioning?
My understanding of the San Antonio process is, first of all, they talk to all 100 of them together. Then as they start to do them individually based on their questionnaires, they bring them into the room alone, where in that room is the defendant, defense attorneys, and the prosecution.
Well, now, I thought the questionnaires were filled out and were given to counsel at least a day in advance. So as I recall reading that both sides had the questionnaire, so that the request in this case for a shuffle came at the outset. They knew, obviously, from looking at the questionnaires, or at least they could have known, depending on the reasons for it, that they were going to ask for a shuffle. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor, because once again, the questionnaires reveal the race.
Mr. Sullivan, the jury cards are selected randomly, and then there is a jury list. They come in and they sit down, and in that jury list you have, as I recall the way they did it here in San Antonio, is they Xerox the each card, so everything is given to the attorneys ahead of time. My question to you is, when in this process did the prosecutor ask for the reshuffle? I know they sat down, and was it immediate or what?
My understanding of the record is shortly after they were seated, within moments after that, Your Honor, that pretty quickly she asked for a shuffle.
Before an examination of panel?
Yes, Your Honor. That is my recollection of the facts. And at that point...
So the basis for the request for shuffle had to be either the information contained on the questionnaire sheet answers or from a visual observation of the panel itself.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. It can be narrowed down to one of the two. And as Judge Garza pointed out, the only exception, Your Honor, would be this, that in a non-death, all you get are the cards, whereas in a death case, you get this full questionnaire that has a lot more information on it.
And is that given to the prosecutor and the defense attorney before the veneer is seated?
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding is, for instance, I think it's a day or so before they are given.
And so they have already reviewed the information on these cards for some period of time. Is that correct?
Certainly be prudent on their part to do so.
Absolutely. Okay.
Would that complete information allow you to identify a race?
Questionnaire would, absolutely.
You read the questionnaire, you could tell, how would you know, by address or names or?
By the race?
Yes.
It asks them their race.
It's on the questionnaire.
Specific question on there is what race, be it African-American, be it white, be it. And those are provided accordingly. The attorneys would have had those not only before, but it's always been my impression, Your Honor, also that attorneys like to see what the panel looks like when they're all seated. I think sometimes as attorneys we get that impression what we see when they seat them.
Now, once the request for shuffle is made, or was made in this case, what exactly happened thereafter to effectuate that shuffle?
My understanding is the jurors are taken back outside. The bailiff or one of the clerks will again take those 100 cards and literally reshuffle them as you would a deck of cards.
Well, now, let me back up. I asked you if they were mathematically random, and your last answer tells me that the answer to that is really no. You don't get a mathematical random exception by just shuffling the deck. How are the first members of the venire selected? Do you take a number? Are you familiar with a random selection mathematically where you choose a control number and then you...
I openly admit I am
not. Well, apart from the detail of that, do you know whether or not the first 100 persons were selected from a larger group by a random process?
And once again, that's too finite for me to have ever gotten that far in this case.
And there's nothing in the record to support how they did that. Nor have you brought out that issue, have you?
With respect to how they got to the list the first time around, no, I did not develop anything of record to suggest how that took place.
Well, what we do know, though, is that however they got the first group in there, well, you knew that they knew, the lawyers knew, both sides knew the seating sequence, and they knew the race before a shuffle was requested, however that first panel was made up.
Correct.
And then the shuffling just consisted of jumbling up the cards again.
And once again,
like shuffling a deck.
That's been my understanding based on my 20 years experience with the Bexar County. The way they do that is literally shuffle it as you would a deck of cards.
Is there a state court rule that sets out a process, or is there a state statute that regulates it?
I don't know if there's any state statute.
I'm zeroing in on what's not in the record. I want to know if there's a legal requirement out there that as to what the practice was commanded is.
And I think the best way for me to answer that is I'd like to put that in a Rule 28J letter, Your Honor. Yeah. I'd like to put that in a Rule 28J because I do not know, and I can find out expeditiously for the court.
I think there should be, from my days as a district judge down there should be an order, and they do shuffle
they do shuffle that in the jury room. Now, whether what they do the second time when they ask for a jury shuffle, I don't, you know, specifically know. But and that's another thing. Not only is race, but religion, occupation, address, military service, plus police service is also and then relatives also that are maybe associated with police officers is also included in this in the questionnaire.
It is my understanding that every death penalty, the prosecution and the defense team will get together with the judge sometime before the hearing and start to develop what they believe should go into the jury questionnaire. Some of them go beyond that. What are your feelings about the death penalty? Are you against the death penalty? Are you for the death penalty? Can you put that aside? Any number of additional questions might be on there based on what they've come to agree to.
Mr. Sullivan, the big question in my, you know, factually, the big question in my that concerns me is, I question whether the shuffle in any way, forget about Miller L for the time being, and the history involved in the Dallas situation, whether the shuffle in any way informs the Batson challenge in this case. In other words, you can look at the question and answers, and it seems to me that if you look at the responses to the death penalty questions, that a prosecutor could reasonably exercise a peremptory strike on Ms. Johnson. Secondly, you got the overlay of the state habeas court saying that there was no deficiency. And then thirdly, you have to show us in clear and convincing evidence that somehow that's unreasonable. Now, you focus please on why you think the state habeas court was unreasonable in finding that there was no deficiency, first of all.
And once again, as I understand your question, Your Honor, leaving Miller L, whatever Miller L says.
No. You can obviously use that as a backdrop to your, you know, to your. But you don't have the same history. We don't have the same history here that the Dallas courts had. It seems to me, or the Dallas District Attorney had.
Certainly, Your Honor. Not the specific. There was no specific statistical information developed. There was no specific memorandums in the office that showed.
You don't have the same evidence pattern.
Absolutely
not.
The
DA's office in Dallas had it in writing. That's the.
But, Your Honor, both honors, I submit to the court that each Batson challenge brings to the court a unique set of circumstances. What we have here is we first of all submit that Johnson was a problem challenge for the prosecution. What makes it even more persuasive that there are problems with the Batson challenge when you see what happened with the jury shuffle. And I think part of your question, Your Honor, we're not saying that the jury shuffle solely within itself became a peremptory challenge in this case. And I think that's what Miller L. would require us to do if we were to rely on that type of law. But we're not.
Yeah, clearly they still excluded shuffles from peremptory challenges. In Miller L, it seems to me they're saying, look at the challenge, but then look at the history that kind of reinforces that this was that the rationale given by the prosecutor was not correct.
I believe there's a broader holding in Miller L which tells us this well-established rule of law. And that is, when you look at that specific challenge, you can look at anything that could be relevant with respect to whether or not that challenge was indeed. For instance, it could be purely, as we are arguing, just a challenge and a statement by the prosecutor,
sure,
which the attorney should have noticed that was, should have keyed him off that there was a problem here, that there was an issue, a Batson issue here. And so to say that there's always has to be a broad pattern of discrimination to go along with the challenge to have Miller L. kick in, I respectfully disagree with the court. I think I read Miller L. a little bit differently, Your Honor.
What you're talking about is whether the shuffle would constitute some evidence of intentional discrimination that would shore up the Batson challenges. I mean, just strengthen the Batson challenges from the standpoint of the defense lawyer.
Absolutely.
All right, but then you get down to the question of where the ineffective assistance comes in. And because we're not talking about a Batson claim here in this case, we're talking about an ineffective assistance claim, initially maybe of trial counsel, but basically of appellate counsel. And the claim is exactly what? The appellate counsel failed to do what?
Your Honor, both appellate and trial counsel, we assert under the court that they had this opportunity and a necessity to show that this, the highly discriminatory nature of the shuffle. And what happened was it got put into a footnote by appellate counsel. The trial lawyer never put in sufficient amount of evidence, even to tell us where the jurors were, which was 2-4.
Yeah, but doesn't the second prong of Strickland inevitably take you back derivatively to the underlying question of the strength or not of the Batson claim itself?
Absolutely. We inevitably
we're
have
talking about the Sixth Amendment, not the 14th Amendment, but derivatively, you've got to go back to the whether or not there was at least some kind of a claim that that would fly. Is that correct?
We inevitably have to show an equal protection.
You're not claiming it, and I understand ineffectiveness that that the trial counsel, you're saying, he didn't develop it. I thought you were just saying he didn't preserve the record, proper objections and so forth. What precisely was his failing?
Failings begin not only with the timeliness of his objection to the shuffle, but what happens when he starts to clarify the record as to what happened pre-shuffle and what happened post-shuffle, particularly.
Insofar as this particular juror we've been focusing on, when that happened, trial counsel then picked up on the shuffle and came back to it.
Correct.
And then the state habeas court state trial judge cut him off. He would not, I thought your argument would be that he was trying to perfect a Batson claim at that point. But he never got there.
My understanding is not just so much cut off by the judge, but a complete failure to put that those first jurors were at 2, 4, and 20. That never happens. He never finds any way to put that of record. And that's essential to him showing that this shuffle is discriminatory.
Mr. Sullivan, let's talk about that for Ms. Johnson was what, juror number 8?
No, I think she got pushed. I don't know where she was at first. But I think she ended up back at 60, I believe her number was 60-something. I believe she was the first juror they got to was in the 60s.
Now, she was obviously voir dire.
Yes, sir.
Was she then within that group that was considered after all the strikes, strikes for cause?
Yes, she would be within the group after the challenges.
If that's the case, what is the effect of that shuffle?
The effect of the shuffle, it's not so much the effect of the shuffle as we see it what happens afterwards, Your Honor. We submit you have to go back and look at the shuffle and ask yourself, was there discriminatory intent to get those jurors shuffled back and decrease the possibility
went from what place to what place on the shuffle?
The specific juror, I cannot remember where she was to begin with. My recollection is the African Americans were 2, 4, and 20, and then they were in the 60s after the shuffle, is my recollection.
But you don't remember which was which.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I can modify that with a 28J.
But
once again,
stay with me just a second. I'm not completely clear about your response to the earlier questions as to the effect of the shuffle. You say she ended up after the shuffle. In a seat where she would have been on the jury had she not been struck. Is that correct or not?
She ended up in a seat where she would have been on the jury had she not been struck.
So she had moved. Now, how many jurors were seated? 12?
12. And 2 alternates.
So she. Okay. And so I'm just trying to figure. I said, looking at that, you got 100 jurors and you. And she moves to. It's very important where she would move to, and I thought the briefs were clear about that. but I don't remember now which it was.
Wasn't she number two at the start or number three?
2 to 60, I thought.
And then she moved to either 64 or 68.
And once again, all we've concentrated on in our brief was that they were 2, 4, and 20, and then lo and behold, the first African Americans in the 60s.
Sure.
I've not specifically taken them aside.
See, but you know what you just finished saying, that the, you know, there were two, three, and 20, I believe, were the ones that were close to the front. But did that even have an effect vis-a-vis Ms. Johnson? And that's any effect. It can't be discriminatory if she was in the pool.
I would submit to the court, for instance, John, if I could use a hypothetical.
Sure.
Starting at 2 and 4 and 20, if they were to ask for a shuffle and the African Americans end up at 1, 2, and 3.
No, I understand. I understand what you're saying.
I think you'd still show discriminatory intent.
Well, there are two different strands here. One is the question of whether or not the shuffle independently was a violation. The other is whether the evidentiary significance, as Judge King was pointing out, of the of the shuffle itself. The fact that where she ended up, in fact, is not determinative of that.
I would agree, Your
Honor. In other words, as I understand your argument, it is that they made the shuffle. They didn't know where she was going to end up when they made the shuffle, but your argument is that they sure tried to move her into another zone, and that still remains evidence of it bears on the later treatment of this particular juror.
I would submit to the court it's not a matter of eyeballing Johnson when you make the shuffle. It's a matter of eyeballing where all the African Americans are, if we are to show discriminatory intent when they're so far up to the front.
Well,
so your argument really is that the shuffle's effect is only that it shows discriminatory intent coupled with the questioning of the prosecutor of Ms. Johnson.
Absolutely.
And it informs that rationale that she gave.
It is a powerful circumstance that must come into play when any African American was being challenged for that matter on an individual basis or being struck on an individual basis.
Is that, in your view, is that clear and convincing evidence, and what case do you have to support that?
Your Honor, first of all, within itself, do I have a specific case to support that? No.
Okay.
Other than the clear holding in Murphy, and that is this is a fact-intensive inquiry, as I read the Murphy case, interpreting Miller. Any number of facts can make the turn with respect to, nor are we required to be completely like Miller L. I think we can look at Miller L and literally say, when you look at her shuffle, she gives these reasons for the shuffle, and then it's abundantly clear that none of those occupations, with the exception of one, were in that first 20.
Ms. Yes. Sullivan, you're about to sit down. When you come back, I want to make sure that the prosecutor knows this. I'm going to ask you about Sparks, his testimony, and the effect of Dr. Sparks' testimony on
I do
on
want
this
to get to
issue.
That.
Okay, gotcha.
Thank you.
Ms. Behrens?
Excuse me, may it please the court? pardon me. I'm going to talk about the jury shuffle first. You know the facts. I do want to say that I...
Would you get closer to the microphone, because you're really...
Stay up close and personal with that mic.
Which one is it?
I think it's that one.
That
this one?
Just,
okay.
Yeah, get, there you go.
Okay. There, is that better? Okay. The positions of the jurors, there were two... The first two
I'm sorry,
jurors,
I can't hear you. You're going to have to speak up.
Okay. Let me see if I can get closer.
You can do that. Just
pull it in.
Yeah. I suspect you know how to raise your voice. Do it.
Haven't in a while. My kids are grown. There were three African Americans in the first 20 seats of the panel. The first two of them were males, and one was a female. I'm not sure if that was Ms. Reddick or Henderson or Johnson, but Ms. Johnson took seat 68. She was the second juror, African American juror, to be questioned. I guess I'm going to jump to the end, but when we're talking about the effect of the shuffle, I think we need to deal with whether or not Mr. Blanton was prejudiced by the shuffle. And one of the ways you can look at this is if you look at the questionnaires of the two black jurors who were removed from the possibility out of the 82 that were 82 members that were actually questioned. They were beyond that. Now
they dropped below the strike zone.
That's correct. And actually, there
were... So the shuffle allowed you to use those two parameters elsewhere.
Yes. There are actually 14 strikes per side in this case. And in the capital case, there are, I believe, 16.
16.
For alternatives, yes. Because they do select at least one alternative.
There are 32 strikes.
Pardon?
32 strikes.
Yes. Now, looking at the effect, and you look at the questionnaires of the two African-American jurors who were not questioned, it's clear that they would have been struck. Both of them expressed their opposition to the death penalty and their inability or unwillingness to impose it. So, I don't think that Mr. Blanton could have suffered any prejudice because nothing really changed for him. That's our view of the prejudice. It's just not.
So in other words, there were three African Americans in the first veneer group that were in the pool of possible jurors. And there were three at the end. Is that what you're saying?
I believe actually there were four in the original count. There was one below the strike zone, and
yeah, what I have is 2, 3, and 20, and then 82 and 98. Then after the shuffle, it was 64, 68, 76, and then 87 and 90.
Okay, I'm not very good at math, and I'm not sure what the strike zone is, but I know there were 82 panel members voir dire. So. And that would have meant four African Americans would have, because one of the positions was there, was within that area.
You're going to seat the first 12 jurors that were Nariman that remained after the strikes, and is that correct? In other words, they're seated 1 through 100, and then you take the first, you stay with that numerical sequence. You take the first 12 that remain at the end of the selection process. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So you'd have 32 strikes?
Yes.
Everybody taking all the preemptors out, there are 68 remaining.
Yes.
Right?
Well,
that's before you get, how many people went out for cause?
Well, let's see, that would be approximately 38, maybe. Is that right? 32 plus... Actually, the peremptory strikes weren't actually that many.
No, you start with the fact that I've seen everybody exercise their peremptors. You told me there were 32 peremptors, 16 to a side. That's 68 now out there. And 12 of those people are going to be jurors.
Okay.
So that leaves 56 people out there that have to be accounted for by challenges for cause.
Yes.
And so that's my... what I'm talking about the practical effect of moving these black Benjamin persons to the back end of the selection process when you're going to take the first 12, because everybody has struck their peremptors and you still have 56 persons, and then you have how many persons were there that went off for cause, and I don't know we don't know the answer to that.
I didn't bring that. I believe it's in the brief.
That number, less 56, still leaves you a substantial number of persons. So
yes.
What I'm getting at is the real world situation as to what's the effect of moving these black Benjamin to the back of the panel.
I'm not sure how.
In terms of their opportunity to serve.
I think it was diminished a bit, simply because. If the same number of jurors...
Diminished, how would they be reached?
Well, assuming everything's otherwise equal, four black veneer members would have been questioned had there been no shuffle. Afterward, there were three. So in that sense, there was a reduction in the chances that one would be selected. However, what we're saying is that that would not have occurred. It would not have mattered, rather, because the two jurors that were excluded by the shuffle were opposed to the death penalty, and I think they would have been excused for cause.
Were there any black members of the venire that were not struck by the prosecution?
One of them was excused for cause. Two African Americans were struck by the state.
Okay. So. Well, that pretty well did it.
Yes. Now, speaking of the shuffle itself, the Texas statutes provide that there can be a shuffle. Texas.
There can be even two shuffles, if I recall the law.
Well, either side has the opportunity. It's unclear to me whether there's only going to be one allowed per jury or whether there can be two. I think there.
But two can possibly occur. In other words, at the very least, the defense attorney could have reshuffled that if he didn't like the veneer pool as it sat the second time. Is that correct?
I think it is. Yes, I know that they.
It didn't happen, but that's correct. The law. That's the Texas law.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. The law. The Texas law provides for it. Now, as for the shuffle, going back to the shuffle and the failure of counsel to object to it on Batson grounds. I mean, he had no basis, and that's clear.
Well, let me ask you clarify something. I'm not sure exactly what happened at trial. Counsel. Did not object to the shuffle. We know that at the time that the shuffle occurred.
At that time, yeah.
Then in the course of the voir dire, he objected to the strike of this particular veneerman. Is that right?
Yes.
And then he also requested that at that point, did he ask the trial judge at that time to require the prosecution to articulate non-racial reasons for the shuffle?
Yes.
And the
court denied it.
And that was denied. Now, earlier, yes. I asked the question whether or not he was, the trial court cut him off. That's pretty much a cutting off of any Batson inquiry when you refuse to make the inquiry. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
But the court had no basis
So in terms of whether the trial counsel, the trial counsel here had done all that he could do, and that point would seem to be preserved, whatever be the merit of that issue.
Yes.
So, I mean, if there is a question, there's no question, I take it, but on behalf of the state, with regard to whether or not the merits of the Batson claim with regard to the Johnson is before us.
Yes.
Well, I bet in the context of ineffective assistance to preserve it. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that is.
One thing I don't understand, the opposing counsel said that, and the briefs say, that the record didn't contain the order of the jurors. Now, he asked that the lawyer, when he raised the question about the reason why the state had done the shuffle and was denied that, he asked that the record be preserved on that. I don't remember exactly how he put it. And the court said that would happen, but apparently it didn't happen.
Well, actually, I think it did. And I think the problem was, at some point in his request, he asked or made a comment that these things should be sealed.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
That the records, the juror questionnaires and the records should be sealed.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I think because they have information on them that should remain private to the individuals.
Well, but that would mean that we would have them, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Why is it that the record is somehow incomplete on this? He asked that the record be preserved.
Yes, and the record was preserved in the court. As a matter of fact, we got an order from the district court to unseal the juror questionnaires and lists in the state court, and they did that, and they sent us the questionnaires. We filed them in the district court, provided copies, and we also asked that they be sealed. So they are there.
They're there. Where is there?
In the district court. In the district court.
The words of Gertrude Stein, they know they're there.
Well, the district court had the same problem as the state court, and it might not have forwarded them to you, but they were submitted to the district court. And included with the juror questionnaires were two lists. The original seating of the panel and then the reshuffled panel. So all that information is there, and that's what we based our argument.
So whatever may be your opposing counsel's view, in your view, he did ask that the record be preserved, and it was in fact preserved.
Yes, it was. The fact
so
that
the
it
failure of counsel here is not in preserving the record, it's simply in not having objected to the shuffle at the time the shuffle occurred, rather than asking for the reasons for it later.
Yes, that's my understanding. He's also objecting to the fact that trial counsel did not preserve the comment allegedly made prior to the shuffle.
But the only issue before us vis-a-vis trial counsel is failing to preserve their objection to the state jury shuffle and failing to preserve evidence which could be used to show the jury shuffle was discriminatory.
Yes.
That's the only thing that's before us as far as the trial counsel. Now, maybe the appellate counsel.
But that's what she's saying. She's saying that the record is complete.
Yes.
So the second
But it almost makes no difference. It seems that trial counsel did everything he had to do to preserve the record. Now, that the court may have erred in that, that's something else.
Yes.
The problem here is that, and this is the thing that I find confusing, this is a Strickland claim, not a Batson claim that's before us.
Yes.
And so whether or the question is whether or not the attorney was deficient in what he did, and that's the overlay, as I understand it, that is before us. Only, did he fail to preserve the objection, which I think both sides have said that he did object to it.
He did object to it. Further, when he objected to it is probably the only point when he could have objected to it, because he could not have known when the request was made for the shuffle that it may or may not have had a discriminatory intent.
Now, to be horribly fair on everybody in this case, Miller L. had not even been issued yet, had it not?
No. As a matter of fact, both trial counsel and appellate counsel more or less presaged Miller L. in their approaches. While Mr. Cantrell objected to the shuffle as a Batson violation, he was making a case for it being a factor in the Batson violation for Johnson strike. Appellate counsel argued comparing the juror questionnaires and the voir dires, rather, with the African American struck and the juror selected. So they made some of the same arguments.
Yeah. Ms. Barron, but that dovetails perfectly into the appellate court counsel's Strickland claim, and that is, what is your argument for the fact that appellate counsel knew of Miller or should have known of Miller L. prior to the issuance of the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, failed to do that and didn't even move to rehear, and even furthermore, not even the Court of Criminal Appeals cites Miller L., which is, it seems to me, like the case that informs this whole appeal.
Well, actually, we don't agree, and simply because Miller L. was not decided on the facts of that case. The Miller L. court remanded the case on a COA determination, and it did not find that the facts were indeed discriminatory. It addressed them, surely, But that was not the holding. So there's no reason to, there's no point in even looking at it because since it's not relevant to what's happening here.
Okay.
So I think appellate counsel could have looked at that case and said, there's no application here. I don't have anything to go on.
But it clearly informs whether or not there was intent. Because now for the first time, there is law that says that the jury shuffle could inform the intent of the prosecutor in challenging African-American juror.
Yes, it does say that.
Did you really need Miller L. to say that? I mean, this is just a matter of common sense. It happens that in Miller L., with a lot of other evidence, that there was a jury shuffle and that was used. But the law regarding shuffles hasn't changed, has it?
No, it has not.
And when you just have an evidentiary circumstance that you have persons, minorities in the group, and they're moved out of it without any voir dire, then that in and of itself at least supports an inference that race was there. But even though you don't attack the shuffle, you go back to Michelle Johnson. Look at her. It struck her on her questionnaire. She was a member of the military reserve. She had 2 years of college. No questions were asked her about her views about the death penalty, et cetera. So that you had to strike her to get rid of her because the shuffle didn't take care of it. Otherwise, you wanted to burn the peremptor. And then, secondly, the examination of her was quite different from the other jurors. In and of itself, that seemed to make a prima facie case of Batson, wouldn't it? Or would it? And why doesn't that meet Batson, regardless of the? We don't need Miller L. to tell us that. This is
no,
Batson.
No, we don't. And if you, it's true that Johnson's voir dire was different from the jurors that were selected. But I don't. What we looked at is the non-African Americans who were struck.
Well, why did you strike her?
She was struck, as I recall, the prosecutor said she was struck because she thought that it was not this. It was up to God. Life and death was up to God, and she also said that it was the burden of proof was beyond a shadow of a doubt, and that she herself would have a hard time imposing the penalty. Now, I think looking at selected questionnaires, you can see that Johnson's answers reflected a uncomfortableness, a conflict with the penalty and imposing it, and I think that was what the prosecutor was looking at.
Well, the federal district court said, and let me just read it to you and tell me where you think he's in error. He said, this court's independent review of the examination of Venari member Johnson, along with Johnson's juror questionnaire, reveals the prosecution's voir dire questioning when compared to the voir dire questioning of other members was unusually perfunctory. It included only vague allusions to the law. It seemed intended so to highlight those answers. The answer that she gave on her juror questionnaire, unlike his treatment of other Venari members, prosecution made no serious effort to explain the law to Johnson, who had 2 years of college, or to ascertain if she could set aside her personal opinions and render a verdict based solely on the law and evidence. She was struck even though her questionnaire revealed she was a member of the military reserve, et cetera. So the district court was taken by the differential treatment of it.
Yes, and we don't.
What do we as appellate court do with that?
Well, if you're looking just at what the district court looked at, and that would be the jurors, the actual chosen jurors, yeah, there is a disparity. But we don't have the questionnaires from the actual jurors. We only have those who weren't selected. So we don't know what they put on their questionnaires. But we do know that some of the jurors that were non-African-American jurors who were struck, we also had the same type of answers on their questionnaires that Ms. Johnson had. They were opposed to the death penalty to a degree.
What did she say? So do you have her? What were her answers that you say disclosed to her opposition to capital punishment?
Her answers to I have the questionnaire here if you'd like to see them. But as I recall,
were their answers on the questionnaire or were their answers on the
questionnaire is what we looked at because we believe that that's what. The prosecutor was going on. She looked at the questionnaire, saw that the answers were ambivalent or conflicted about the penalty, and so she had a certain set of questions for those people, those who didn't have that conflict evident in their questionnaires were given something different. They were given the script of the law. They were given more detail because they had not expressed opinions or beliefs that caused her concern, and that's what we're contending.
Well, so are you saying that the prosecutor essentially decided to strike her based on the questionnaire?
Yes.
And so, you really agree with the district court that the examination of the witness was purely perfunctory.
Yes.
The decision that they made, we're going to strike her.
It was designed, we believe, that to ferret out, if you will. Her feelings, the feelings of those jurors, or those panel members, rather, who might be a holdout, who might be a stealth juror, who might not be able to impose the death penalty.
Did the trial counsel ask the district court to require the prosecutor to articulate the reasons?
Yes.
And what were the reasons given at that time?
The reasons for striking Ms. Johnson?
Yes.
Okay. Her reasons, as I recall, were that she felt that it was the question of life and death was up to God. It wasn't for.
Let me be more specific. When asked by the trial judge to articulate the reasons for the strike in a Batson inquiry, did the prosecutor at that time say that based on her answers to the questionnaire?
I'm not sure. I can't tell you for sure. I know that
I understand the argument you made, but my question is, was that the reason that the prosecutor gave?
I don't think it wasn't based on just the questionnaire.
I don't understand it's not based just on the questionnaire. The examination, you said, was perfunctory. And you'd already decided to strike, so it wasn't based on the voir dire, it was based on the questionnaire.
Okay, if I could read some of what she said to you, I can do that.
Ma'am?
I have her statement here. She stated that it's against her religious beliefs, that it's only up to God to take a life, and that she's had these religious beliefs for a long time. She said she's confused about the death penalty. She believes that capital punishment is only appropriate for premeditated cases, and many reasons like
that?
This, but none of them, she doesn't identify where
the prosecution disagree with that.
Pardon?
You don't want a juror that thinks that the capital punishment is limited to premeditated killings?
The prosecutor does not.
I thought you wanted to obey the law.
Yes. No, she.
I'm not picking on you. I don't understand what you're saying.
I understand. Now, that's not the standard. That premeditation is not an element of a capital crime. So,
it's an insistence that the person intend to take a life, and I think that's an Eighth Amendment requirement.
Yes. I'm not sure if you want to go into the mitigation at this point or not. I only have a few minutes left. If you
Please.
Want to talk about it, you said.
My concern is again. With regards to the habeas setup here, we have conflicting testimony. Dr. Sparks was the medical doctor. The judge believed Sparks. The Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed on that, found that affirmed on that, and then. My question, and it's really to Mr. Sullivan, is how does he get passed the habeas standard in this case that requires clear and convincing evidence that the state habeas court was unreasonable in its finding. And you can...
Well, I can only say about that, I mean, that obviously it wasn't unreasonable, but there it's a very simple reading. There was no organic brain damage. There was nothing in those medical records. And that was the test to indicate that Mr. Blanton had suffered any kind of damage as a result of those incidents in his early life. And that was the testimony of Dr. Sparks. And
there is no objective test to any CAT scans or MRIs that indicate any type of organic.
Apparently none were ever done. But over the years, especially when Mr. Blanton was in the custody of the state and the Texas Youth Commission, he was evaluated. And in all of those evaluations, there is no evidence, nothing is put forward that indicates organicity. It was, or any kind of brain damage. I mean, they talk about his bicycle accident when he hurt, when he might have had a bump on the head. Well, he was taken to the emergency room, he got some treatment. 3 months later, they take him back for a follow-up, but his concern is a scar, not a loss of consciousness or seizures or any kind of motor impairment. The breech birth, Apgar scale of 1 at 1 minute, Apgar scale of 9 at 5 minutes. He had anoxia, but when he was born, but it immediately cleared, and there was no residual damage. He was in the hospital as a precaution. He was incubated for a few days, released on day 6 of his life. So there's just nothing in the records that should have gotten before the court, the jury, that would have changed the outcome of this trial, or his sentence, rather, in this case. So the experts that Mr. Blanton looked at or used at his state habeas hearing were just incorrect on many of the findings that they had, and they did not. They made statements that had no basis, and they were based on suppositions and speculations as to what might have happened early in his life and not what did happen in his life. So it could not have prejudiced the case that these medical records did not get before the jury. And finally, his mitigation specialist, Lester Hart, she tried and she did get all of the information that was critical before the jury in this case. She might have been better credentialed, a more impressive resume, but nonetheless, she did her job. So Mr. Blanton's counsel did not fail him there. So, my time is up.
Thank you. Mr. Saul.
When I sat down, as I understood Judge Garza's order, I was to come forth and answer some questions about Dr. Sparks.
Well, tell me why that finding by the state court, habeas court, is unreasonable.
Go ahead. First of all, there are several reasons. First of all, we point out that Dr. Sparks never tested my client. Dr. Potter did. In fact, he even got on the stand and verified Dr. Potter, that his testing methods were sound.
One of the problems with, as I understand, Dr. Potter is a psychologist. Is that correct?
That's right.
And it's even Mr.
I apologize.
And Dr. Sparks is a psychiatrist.
That is correct.
And as I understand Texas law, a psychologist, even a PhD psychologist, cannot diagnose organic brain injury.
It is my understanding that anybody with training in neuro background can diagnose organic brain damage. It's my understanding, once again, and incidentally, none of that came out from the hearing. The state never contested Mr. Potter's findings and Dr. Cox's findings along the same lines. They never contested it along those lines, Your Honor. They contested it quite simply by putting Dr. Sparks up there. Dr. Sparks said he had never tested him. and said he didn't see organic brain damage. It's also important to note that Dr. Sparks testified, we make findings of organic brain damage every day in my office without CAT scans, without MRIs. My understanding of organic brain damage, I believe this is in the record, is that it comes down to the testing of the individual as to whether or not they have it. More significantly, Your Honor, isn't so much a matter as to whether or not the judge would conclude I find OCD. The difficulty here is that there were significant medical records left out that any psychologist could start to render an opinion on that are substantial, that show this young man was born near death with an APGAR score of 1. Even the defense attorney said that would have a substantial impact on the jury.
That was only for a period of 12 days, and then the record shows that he returned to normal, though.
But nevertheless, Your Honor.
He went to a 12, I thought, and then but I would whatever the number was.
I don't remember the days, but I would submit to the court that the trial attorney disagreed with the court. And that was, yes, he believed this would have a substantial impact on the jury. That type of evidence was, and that was the type of evidence he could have found, he admits that, and should have found.
Let me ask you a question. we do not have a Batson claim before us. Is there a reason for that?
The reason there is no pure equal protection claim before this court, except first of all, I submit if we were to bring one, it could only be with respect to Juror Johnson.
That's right.
And we would have to completely abandon any mention of the evidence of the shuffle, which we submit is crucial to a finding that there was a Batson violation in this case.
You lost me there.
Your Honor, on the direct appeal, the defense lawyer argued, the appellate lawyer argued, that Juror Johnson should not have been excluded. All she did was put a footnote that said, by the way, it ought to apply to Shuffles. There's no evidentiary support for her conclusion.
Let me just ask a question. On direct appeal, was there a Batson claim?
There was a Batson claim.
There was a Batson claim on direct appeal. There's no Batson claim on habeas.
No, we only relitigated it through the guise of ineffective assistance of counsel. That's correct, Your Honor. There's no pure Batson claim in the writ. We agree with that. And under the Gardner Doctrine, we could not have started adding facts because we would have simply defaulted on those facts. Under the Gardner Doctrine.
So habeas counsel abandoned the Batson claim.
What's that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Habeas counsel abandoned the Batson claim.
It was me.
I understand. That's right or wrong. That's where it went out of the case.
No, I did not abandon the Batson claim. Our point is this, that the only way it could have been brought was an IAC claim because you run into too many procedural default problems trying to show that both of these prongs should be considered. It is significant that the trial attorney and the appellate lawyer did not successfully focus in on the jury shuffle sufficiently such that we could bring it straightforward to here as a straight Batson claim, wherein we argue that the jury shuffle is so significant. It had not been fairly presented that way. We obviously are disagreeing with federal district court.
What you're saying is that while a Batson claim was presented in the state courts, that presentation did not include reliance upon the evidentiary significance of the shuffle.
Absolutely.
And you were concerned that had you attempted to do that, that you would say that you're not fairly presented the issue to them.
Correct.
All right.
But isn't that what happened with Miller L?
Miller L made a wonderful record at the trial level by his attorneys.
No, but what I'm saying is that the shuffle argument came within the Batson claim. And that's exactly what could have happened here. It's not that you abandoned anything.
It could not have been brought because it would significantly provide new evidence that was not within the claim as presented to the state court. We could not have brought it. It was not exhausted, John. And that literally comes back to looking at the trial attorney and the appellate attorney's performance. Their lack of performance therein is what prevents us from bringing it that way.
Well, that doesn't sound like trial counsel performance. At best, it would be of the appellate counsel, wouldn't it?
And we are aware, Your Honor, that in many ways we brought it that way because there may be some things to some harm, some of these problems may have been caused by both or either. One of the things I think that I should point out, that in the state court did find the shuffle was waived. Any error with respect to the shuffle was waived. That is clearly the conclusion of the state court. And I would also note for the record that I clarify something. I asked my co-counsel with a little note, is it 15? Well, it is 15-1. I do apologize.
That's true. Only if you were, the only claim that would be waived of that is an independent claim that the shuffle itself violated Batson, which is not the argument that we're talking about at all.
And now we could have brought that perhaps, although we probably have to go back to the loop of ineffectiveness.
All right, I think we have your argument. Thank you,
Your Honor.
The case will be taken under submission, and the court is adjourned.